Hey guys, how many of you guys have had a crazy week? Okay, just me? Okay, no. I feel like there are some weeks that no matter what I do, I end up in a disheveled mess by the time Saturday morning rolls around. I come like barreling in and I get here and I'm like, okay, I'm here. I have clothes on, I showered at some point, and there are humans that are going to be showing up any second, and I get to greet them and be with them, and it's super exciting. But sometimes the getting here part is the challenge, right? And so I just want to give everyone the opportunity to just take one deep breath. Just go. And then let it out. We are here as community. We're here to be vulnerable. We are here to share life and story with. And we have so many things going on in our church, and we just hope that you continue to be part of those things. When I was thinking about my sermon, I was trying to think of something that I have perpetually and notoriously been bad at. And I constantly end up in a similar situation. So as I was thinking about this, I was like, well, this isn't too hard. I have a lot of those things, right? And so I started making lists. And then the one that kept coming forward was kind of an awkward one. And I figured, why not share it with you? Because what would a sermon with me be without me being awkward at some point in the sermon? So we're going to talk about me dating. Yeah. I have a skill set that you guys don't even know about, okay? My dating game is so on point that it's not even on a graph. This is me in every situation. I was thinking about it, and I was like, you know, going on dates, I know that it kind of sounds strange, and maybe it doesn't if you actually know me, but I am awkward, and sometimes I'm quirky, and sometimes I'm just really oblivious of what's going on around me. And so I thought I would give you a couple examples. Through high school, I just didn't date. Why? Because I didn't feel like it. I was lazy, one. Two, all my best friends were guys, so eh. And three, like, it just seemed really complicated to be able to project your feelings and have a definitive answer to how my heart felt while I was a teenager, just wanting to play soccer, climb things, jump around, you know, play games, right? So I just was like, oh, I'm not going to do it. So then I land in college, right? And I went to a school called Southern Adventist University. You guys have heard of this place, yes? Eh. Also known as Southern Matrimonial College, right? And there's these awkward moments where Friday afternoon, my roommate and I would be sitting in our room, and the phone would ring, and it would be date night for everyone, because dates at Southern consisted of Vespers, right? The best pickup game was call Friday and say, hey, will you go to Vespers with me? And then, of course, that's so romantic, but you fall madly in love, and you go to Vespers together. I never did that because I, again, thought that was kind of strange, and I'm lazy. And I was really going to Vespers because I actually liked God. So I figured I don't really need that. Then this day came. I remember I was up front. I was speaking. I did a week of prayer for the school, and at the very end of it, like at the end of one of my talks, it was like a Thursday night, I walked down and this guy comes up to me and he was like, I have so much I want to talk to you about. And I was like, great, I love talking to people about stuff. And he's like, yeah, do you think we can get together sometime and talk? And I'm like, sure. When would you like to get together and talk? And so he says, let's go next Wednesday night. What's your schedule like? And I was like, oh, I have one of my classes till this point, but I'll get out of work or a class around like 6 or 7. He's like, perfect. I'll meet you at the art department. So I was an art major at the time. And so I go to classes. I had painting and sculpture that day. And so, of course, I dressed extra classy. And I remember I was walking out of the art department. And I had, like, a huge canvas in one hand, a strange sculpture in the other hand. I had, like, ripped up pants with paint splattered all over. I'm pretty sure I had, like, some pastel or paint on my face because people kept trying to touch my face. But as a classy human being, I totally didn't go look in the mirror because I was just going to talk to some random dude about whatever. I don't know. This fool rolls up in this, like, immaculate car, okay? Like, there is not one spot on the outside. I'm like, wow, this guy might have OCD. Interesting. He gets out, and no joke, his sweater is tucked into his pants. And I was like, I just feel like you're very classy right now. And I kind of stood there, and he was like, oh, you have all this stuff. And I was like, I do have all this stuff, but you're picking me up from class. And so he takes the stuff, he puts it in the back of his car. I get in the car, and no joke, like cup holders, they are never clean. This guy's cup holders were like perfectly detailed and clean. Everything's in a perfect place. He opens the glove compartment and hands me a list of movies showing at different times. And I'm like, what is happening? We get to the restaurant, and it was a very classy restaurant because, you know, in college, that's what you do. It was Panera. And I figured, hey, we're just going to hang out and talk for a little bit, right? And so I get in line, and I'm ordering, and then he jumps in front of me and starts to order. Now, I grew up with mostly boys, and depending on who was going to win the arm wrestling match would depend on who pays for the food, right? So I kind of was jarred because I was like, I don't know this guy well enough to pay for him, but I guess I'm going to pay for him. He jumps in, so I'm like ready to pay, and then he like hands money over to the lady, and I was like, huh, what a classy gent. He has OCD, he tucks his sweater into his pants, he has printouts of all the things happening in Chattanooga tonight, that's excellent, and we're going to eat food, which is yummy. So we sit down and we're talking, and he's talking to me things, but he's not telling me much about himself. He's asking kind of prying questions like, what are you passionate about? And I'm like, life? And then he's like, yeah, when I heard you talk, blah, blah, blah. And he starts going, and I'm sitting there, and I'm like slowly eating my soup and just kind of watching his face move. And I'm like, uh-oh. This isn't like a pastoral counseling situation, is it? And so I'm like, okay, the only way to figure this out is run to the bathroom really quick, right? Because every girl knows the bathroom is your sanctuary. So I run to the bathroom, I take my phone with me, and I call my best girlfriend, and I'm like, hey, dude, hypothetically, if a guy picks you up and his car is super clean, he tucks his sweater into his pants, and he pays for your dinner, and he asks really prying, weird questions, what's happening? She's like, you're on a date, you're an idiot. Oh. Okay. So I'm like, she's wrong. She's a girl. She's always going to assume everything's a date. So I call my brother, right? I'm like, hey, Ivan, really quick question. Hypothetically, if a guy shows up with a really clean car, tucks his sweater into his pants, has a list of all the movies going on, and pays for your dinner, he's like, you're on a date. Stop calling. So let's just say that went a little awkward when I finally got back to the table, and I'm sitting there like, now what do I do with my hands? Like, let's stand up here. Like, hi, you know, like, I don't know what to do then. I'm, like, super awkward. I don't know how to carry on conversation. I have anxiety. My armpits are getting hot. I don't know what's happening. I'm just sitting there in a mass panic. And I'm like, how do people do this on a regular basis? This is precisely why I don't go on dates. Phase two. Trust me, I got out of that one in a very classy way, but we don't need to talk about it. Then, about a year later, I'm still at Southern. It's my second year at Southern, and I was a quadruple major, so at this point I was also doing my education. And so I had teaching schedules going on as well, so I was teaching at this school in Chattanooga, and I was teaching art. And so I made friends with one of the senior art majors in my school because they knew a lot more about sculpture than I did, and I was like, you have to teach me how to teach sculpture. And he's like, absolutely. So we spent a lot of time creating sculptures. And I remember there was this one day we spent tons of time together, and there's this one evening where there is a hoedown, because that's what you do in Tennessee, and we're at these people's like huge massive farm, and there's lights everywhere, and we're out like hoedown dancing, you know, so I'm like doing my stupid dance moves, and my brother is humiliated by me, so he's standing way over there, and my friend is with me, Randy. And eventually some other friends come around, and my brother comes around, and we're all talking. And at one point someone says, are you guys dating? And I said, nope. And he said, yup. And I said, what? And my brother is like, oh my word. And that's how I got my first boyfriend. That's right. Dated him for a solid year. Awesome. And then you think that after college, maybe I would have figured out the rhythm of how to be a normal human being and go on dates. You would think that because I like people, because I like talking, because I know how to interact with most human beings, and I don't have all those nervousnesses that most people have, unless apparently I'm on a date, you would think that I would have this figured out. So let's just go to like 5 months ago, 6 months ago, or last year, right? I lost a bet, and so I had to go. This is way too much information. I had to go on a Bumble. Have you guys heard of Bumble? Super awkward. And I had to do it for like a solid week. And every time like anyone I would match with, I was like, I don't really want to date you. I'm a pastor. Like, I lost a bet. Hi. Huh. You know, like, and so like I pretty much severed every single situation there. Except for this one guy who's like, oh my word, I've lost the faith. I would love to meet up with you and talk. And I said, that's strange, but sure. Right? So we talked. So we met up for coffee and we were going to talk. And I thought, nothing strange about this. Like, he knows I'm a pastor. He's getting pastoral advice. No problem. Partway through this conversation, suddenly, again, those prying questions come out. And I'm like, what is happening? Like, we're not talking about me. We're here to talk about you. And then he's like, do you want to walk and talk? And I was like, yeah, sure. I like walking. And so we have our coffee and we're like walking down the road. And suddenly, I feel a hand on my hand, and I panic instantaneously because I'm so stealthy, and I automatically shoot into what I know best, which is rock, paper, scissors, right? And so I'm like, scissors! And he grabs the two fingers, and then he's like, what is happening? And then he, like, lets go, and he grabs again, and I'm like, fizz, you know? He lets go, and I'm like, ah! And so at one point, I am walking, I have coffee in this hand, and he's holding my wrist in the air, and I'm like, I don't know what's happening, how do I get through this? Ah! And he's, like, mortified by me, and he tells me this. He's like, what is wrong with you? He's like, do you have the fear of holding hands? And I was like, no, I don't. I don't have the fear of holding hands. What I have the fear of is strange men holding my hand when I'm walking, drinking coffee, supposed to be giving pastoral advice. And he was like, oh, yeah, you should talk this through with a therapist. Like, he goes on and on. No joke. After that date, he texted me like 25 articles on, what is it called, chirophobia or something like that, the fear of holding hands, which is an actual problem for some people. And I'm like, this guy, I don't know what to do with this. This is so stressful and ridiculous. And here I end. I'm 33. And I'm still in this vicious cycle of not knowing what's happening around me most of the time, right? And so this is how life goes. This is how there are moments in our lives, there's these things in our lives that come crashing in and we get stressed out and we keep relapsing into the same situations over and over and over again. And it's all because I wasn't paying attention. And this does happen a lot. I miss what's going on and I relapse into self-induced chaos constantly. The beautiful thing, though, is that even amidst my personal chaos that I am creating myself, I have community. I have a group of people around me that despite all of my chaotic stories, I can call up and say, hey, Betty, FYI, this just happened. Yeah. And she'll laugh at me, and then she'll be like, you're fine. Keep moving. You know, and we have people in our lives that go through these journeys with us, no matter how chaotic and weird and disturbing they may be. The beautiful thing is that we have this support and community. And it's supposed to be found in church. There's something interesting about history. It often repeats itself even when we don't want it to. You see, there's this relapsing of history and struggles throughout the Bible. Struggles with understanding law and God's plan. The tribes of Israel are hit pretty hard with this. They constantly are relapsing into a rhythm that maybe was not one that was intended. As most of you know, there are 12 tribes found in the Old Testament. They are the descendants of Jacob, aka Israel. They stemmed from the promise that Abraham's descendants would one day be as multiplied as the stars in the skies. These tribes move through the Old Testament, each of them having a function and a skill set, each of them furthering the vision that was cast to reach the promised land. These tribes are often seen as centered around the temple. They raise their flags in battle together, uniting in times of war. Focused on the purpose to expand Israel and to get their land and the chosen people of God to freedom. At first, they listen to God and have success. And then they do what we all do. They lose focus and they lapse into human wanderings once more, creating personal self-induced chaos. We see it through the Exodus story and pretty much every single story that follows as people continually fall back into the worship of gods that are maybe not the God that was declared the ultimate God. They start worshiping the local gods like Baal or Astartes. Judges 2, 11 to 13 goes into this a little bit more. And then they would get beat up because they would wonder why they would lose battles and get destroyed. And they can't figure out why the rhythm has slowed down and why God is no longer active in their life. It says that God raised up judges to lead. And when the people would follow the judges that God brought forward, they would deliver those who plundered them. It says in Judges 2, 17, yet they did not listen even to their judges, for they lusted after other gods and bowed down to them. The book of Judges goes into madness with people taking it upon themselves to interpret, to lead, and to conquer in their own ways. Only with the judges did victory and peace come in. And as soon as those judges throughout Joshua and Judges died, chaos would come back in full swing. There's one such story which is found in Judges 4. It says that the Israelites again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And after Ehud died, it became more and more challenging. So the Lord sold them into the hand of King Jabin of Canaan, who reigned in Hazar. The commander of his army was Sisera. Then the Israelites cried out to the Lord for help because he had 900 chariots of iron and oppressed the Israelites cruelly for 20 years. So picture this. The Israelites once more are in the midst of chaos because they started worshiping Baal and other gods, and God is allowing other kingdoms to take over. And so King Jabin is being oppressive. He has 900 iron chariots, meaning he has a full battle on hand at any moment. He's way more equipped, way more talented, way more everything than the Israelites, and he's been oppressing them for 20 years. The Israelites just can't win in this situation. It says that during this time, there is a lady named Deborah, and she was one of the judges that God raised up. She would sit under the palm of Deborah, and people would come to her to get wisdom, and they'd ask for advice, and she would guide them through certain things. One day, she sent and summoned Barak, son of Abinoam, from Kedesh in Naphtali. If you guys hear, Naphtali is one of the tribes. And said to him, "The Lord God of Israel commands you, go take position at Mount Tabor, bringing 10,000 from the tribe of Naphtali and tribe Zebulun. I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you, and will give him into your hand." And I love Barak here because he turns to Deborah and he looks her straight in the face and he says, "If you will go with me, I will go. But if you will not go, I won't go." I love the accountability that he throws on Deborah here. And she said, "I'll surely go with you. Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." Barak did as he was told. He summoned the tribes together and he went to Mount Tabor. Sisera heard of this and gathered all 900 chariots, all of the military together, and they began to camp out ready for this battle. Deborah said to Barak, "Up, go, for this is the day on which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. The Lord is indeed going out before you." Now, I love this story because at this moment, the battle begins to rage, right? And so the chariots are racing around. They have all this equipment that the Israelites don't. And at some moment of chaos, it says that God created chaos amongst Sisera's men. And chaos ensued so much that at some point, Sisera jumps out of his chariot, his protection, and begins to run blindly. Not like he can't see, but he's just like, "What do I do?" And he's running around, right? He gets to this camp, and it's a camp that's supposed to be safe because it's people that are supposed to be on the side of King Jabin. And he gets into this camp, and this lady walks out the door. And she said, "Turn aside, my lord, have no fear." So he did what she said. She opened up her tent and said, "Come inside, you're going to be safe here." As you guys know, her name is Jael. And he goes into her tent, he lays down, and he says, she covers him with a rug, and he says, "Do you have any water? I'm so thirsty." She said, "Absolutely." And she opens up a fresh thing of milk, skin, the skin of the milk is what they say. And she gives it to him, and he drinks, and he's so tired that he falls instantaneously to sleep after saying, "If anyone comes nearby, tell them that there is no one here." She walks outside, and you guys know the story, right? Yeah, good nail. She gets a tent peg and a hammer and sneaks back inside and proceeds to put the tent stake through his head into the ground, killing him while he was asleep because he was so tired he didn't even wake up for that. and he died. At that moment, amen. Thanks, Luke. At that moment, she walks outside and she sees the chaos outside and she flags down Barak and she says, "Come and I will show you the man whom you are seeking." And there lied his enemy, dead. After some time, Israel pushed hard enough and destroyed King Jabin. And at the end of chapter 5 of Judges, it says the people listened and the land had rest for 40 years. This is one of those ridiculous stories, right? It's one of those stories that you read and you're like, what is happening? And maybe I did just kind of want to tell the story because it's a weird story in Judges. But there's this thing that happens in Judges constantly, that relapse. It says, and then they followed the Lord and they had peace and rest for 40 years. Judges is basically an example book. The entire book is one big mood swing, a series of relapses. If you look at Judges, just in the first 6 chapters, it says, and the people of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, Judges 2:11. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, Judges 3:12. And then at the end of that, it says, and then they had rest for 80 years once they followed the Lord. And then the people of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, Judges 4:1. And then at the end of that, it says, and the people listened and the land had rest for 40 years. And then you get to chapter 6. The Israelites did evil in the sight of the Lord, right? There's this constant relapse, this constant like tumultuous moments where like people just lose complete focus and just spin out of control and end up back in the same spot they had started. Things start going well and suddenly people land right back where they started, missing the trend in their very own lives. And they lose focus on who God is and who they are called to be. There's a seminal line in the last verse of Judges that I just love, and it shows what has happened when you abandon God. Judges 21:25, it says, in those days there is no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. One of humanity's biggest struggles is looking to something beyond ourselves and not getting caught up in our own eyes and our own ways. Throughout the Old Testament, there is a struggle to figure out the balance between law and God. Each community has a wavering relationship where, again, they do evil in the sight of the Lord. When you get to the New Testament, this is no different. People are trying to follow rules and absolutely failing miserably. This is why there's almost a bigger struggle when Jesus comes on the scene once you hit the New Testament, because he messes with tradition. It isn't so much about displeasing God, but rather that God is not what they always understood him to be. Jesus begins to disrupt the natural order of things, the things that have been for a really long time. He begins to change the focus, reinterpret the law, and talks about the living, breathing temple. Instead of reading the Torah, he begins to teach the embodiment of Torah, which is the way, the truth, and the life. The tribes are no longer fighting for land, safety, and temple, but are now being asked to be safety and temple, the embodiment of God, following a greater commandment of love. In Matthew and Luke, it says that Jesus called together all of his followers and chose 12 after an all-night prayer session. He had met them all at different times, and he had pulled together a group that would follow him through his adult ministry. He had a disheveled, bizarre group that he surrounded himself with, yet one that he would empower no matter how many times they relapsed or continued to go off track. When they kept their eyes on Jesus, they were completely fine. But time and time and time again, Jesus had to regroup his disciples and challenge them to refocus on what he was teaching them. Recasting that vision over and over in different ways so that they could restart. Some people suggest that the 12 tribes move into the 12 disciples, showing the continuation of God's presence and leading throughout scripture and throughout history. However, to me, the biggest point here is that God is patient, even amid the hiccups and the chaos that we have created. No matter what we've done, no matter how many times we've derailed, no matter how many times we end up in the same situation, God comes through and he shows love and compassion, grabs our hand and keeps us moving. A great example of what always is happening with the disciples is pretty much summed up in one of my favorite stories in the New Testament. The story is found in Matthew 14:22, and it's a story that I can't help but visualize very, very clearly. It's a story where Jesus has just finished meeting with a multitude of people and they're pressing in and everyone's getting a little bit stressed. And so Jesus says, you know what? Go ahead of me. Get in the boat. I'll meet you out there. And so the disciples all climb into a boat and they go out and Jesus stays on land. after some time, the waves pick up, things get a little bit crazy, and all the disciples are beginning to freak out because it's the fourth session of the night, and so it's middle of the night, it's dark as all can be, the waves are getting crazier and bigger, and they're getting more and more overwhelmed, and they're fearing for their life. Seems like they end up in this situation a couple times, right? And they're sitting in the boat panicking, and in the middle of this panic, they look out and they see this creepy silhouette, right? Of this guy, this being, out in the distance, through the waves, through the chaos. And they start thinking in their mind. Now think about it yourself. If you were in this situation in a boat in the middle of a lake, right? Chaos is around you, and suddenly, out of nowhere, you see a being just slowly walking towards you, right? You'd be tripping out, right? You'd be like, what is happening? Someone's gonna kill me. I am in my own horror movie, right? And so they look out and they see this being. And at first, I love Peter and I love the disciples so much because it says, the disciples were on the sea and they saw him walking on the sea. They were terrified and said, it's a ghost, right? They yell out, it's a ghost. And they cried out in fear, and it says in verse 27, but immediately Jesus spoke to them saying, take heart, it is I, do not be afraid. Now, I don't know who you would be in this situation, I would still be freaked out. First off, like, it's loud, so who knows what's really happening out there, right? I probably couldn't exactly tell the voice intonation to make sure it's Jesus, but the fact that someone's like, it's cool, it's just the middle of the lake and a crazy storm and I'm just walking around, you know, like, that would still freak me out. And so here the disciples are looking out and everyone's still kind of freaked out, but then suddenly Peter answered him, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. He said, come. So Peter then proceeds to crawl out of the boat in the midst of a chaotic storm that he was just so afraid of losing his life to, crawls out of this boat and begins to slowly walk towards Jesus. Now what happens in the story? As soon as Peter's like five steps away from the boat, he sees a wave, right? He goes, oh no! And as soon as he breaks that gaze, that eye connection with Jesus, he begins to sink and panic and shriek. It says, when he saw the wind, he was afraid and began to sink. He cried out, Lord, save me. Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying to him, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. And those in the boat worshipped him, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. The story is awesome and upsetting all at once, because I feel like Peter, in some senses, was set up for failure, right? Like there's a wave about to demolish him, and because he loses contact with Jesus, he begins to sink. And then he's accused of not having faith. For me, the faith was getting out of the boat, right? In the midst of a chaotic storm. That was the faith step for me. And so I kind of got bummed out when I was like, wait, oh, you have little faith? He was the only one that crawled out of the boat when you said come, right? But then there's this beautiful redeeming moment where it's not so much Jesus like pushing them down saying like, you really are bad at this. But really, it's that Peter was the one saying, God, prove to me that it's you. Call me out to you. And he kept pushing the envelope. And when he finally stepped out, he got distracted once again. His faith was no longer focused. It was just looking all around at all the chaos around him. And that's the thing that causes us to sink. But what I love so much about this story is that Jesus reaches into that idiotic moment, grabs his wrist, pulls him up. And he challenges him, but he doesn't shun him for the rest of his life. He helps grow him. He nurtures him. And even though Peter is the flailing, ridiculous disciple, right, that many of us can relate to, Peter's also the one where Jesus constantly is saying, you're okay. Keep moving. Keep trucking forward. I'll pick you up every time you fall down. Ask all of the stupid questions. Just keep your eyes on me. I also find it interesting and brilliant that Jesus doesn't focus just on the elite. You see, this is a cycle that never seems to end. People are brilliant and scattered, and just like in Judges, we beg people to go on a journey with us into battle, facing the things that threaten us, and just like in Judges, God promises to go before us, picking us up and rebuilding broken community over and over. I love that Peter is so freaked out by Jesus and then immediately launches into full faith in order to lose focus and scream. And God is always there, in the midst of our personal chaos. I love that every person that Jesus encounters has a different story. It's not one group of people that are only okay to be in Jesus' presence. He calls the people from the inside of the temple, but mostly from the outside of the temple. Almost everyone that came to him were people on the outskirts of the temple, never good enough to walk in. The crippled, the people that have been cursed, the people that have been broken time and time again, the Gentiles, the people who were never clean enough to come into that moment or that presence. Jesus called all of them to him. He gathered anyone willing to open their heart to a new way, truth, and life. He started changing the war mentality of conquering land and gaining multitudes into a building to the mentality of love and restoring the land and multitudes into a way of life. He began to breathe life and energy back into humanity again, one person at a time. Jesus did his ministry beyond the walls of physical temple, through action, story, and heart. And every time the disciples wandered away, he would call them back. He would go with them, and he would conquer fears and brokenness. He would empower them to lead and to teach, no matter how many times they sunk. God always showed love for them. God always shows love for us. The disciples began to actually let God work with them, as opposed to the tribes and judges that took it upon themselves to rule as seen fit in their own eyes and often lost focus and were again scattered. It's beautiful what happens when we are united in vision, and the gospel of Jesus gives us a thing to define us and unite us. And this helps us and needs to look different. Old Testament to New Testament looks different. Christianity over the years looks different. We as Christians must look to the thing that unifies us and not to what separates us from the world. Our unifying factor that we have now is love. The way we live and breathe becomes different when we experience this love. Jesus taught them and us to see what was true and good from a kingdom perspective instead of from a self-centered empire perspective. God didn't change throughout history. People changed. We're called to continue to change and grow and create space for healing and love in the temple and on the outskirts of the temple. And just like Judges 4, we're pushed like Barak and Deborah. Go! The Lord is giving it into your hand. And just like in the story of Peter, Jesus calls us out in faith. And when we freak ourselves out, he reaches into that fear and he begins to pull us out of it, whether it's fear of failure, fear of being successful in your job, fear of brokenness, fear of relationship, whatever it may be. God reaches into that chaos and that fear and he pulls you out of it. Even in broken cycles, God is there. God teaches love and empowers our community to be the living, breathing temple with imperfections, but always seeking love. This culture's shift is magic. It's what separates the old from the new. It's what creates life and energy in everything that we do, and it's why we have a message of hope. There's this quote that I came across that I absolutely love. It says, "Before you speak to me about your religion, first show it to me in how you treat other people. Before you tell me how much you love your God, show me in how much you love all of his children. Before you preach to me of your passion for your faith, teach me about it through your compassion for your neighbors. In the end, I'm not as interested in what you have to tell or sell as I am in how you choose to live and give." We are a community of people moving forward in love. Go. Rise up. Love. We are a community full of dysfunction and distraction. God will go ahead of us and lead. Let's go lead. We are a community searching for faith. Crawl out of that boat and walk boldly on the water. God is with you. Go. Be fearless. You may trip up, but even amidst the hiccups and the chaos and all the whirlwinds of life, movement, peace, and hope will shine through. Go. You're not alone. Go.